Maximize cloud efficiency with Doit, the trusted partner in multi-cloud management for thousands of companies worldwide. Visit doit.com. That's doit.com. Doit, your cloud simplified.
Packet pushers.
Hey, you amazing humans. Thank you so much for tuning into this show on Day 2 Cloud. This week, we're talking to Hazel Weekly, an individual contributor come engineering manager come principal architect on DataVance platform team. Her journey combines technical excellence with people leadership and platform guidance, and just generally being a good person that helps the people around them. Ned, what stuck out to you during this talk today?
You know, it's funny, after we stopped recording with her, I was telling you that I kept leaning forward because I was listening so intently and then realizing I was past the pickup pattern of my microphone and having to lean back. So that maybe is the theme of this show, is to lean in. Lean into what Hazel has to say and lean into yourself and what you're capable of if you push yourself into it a little bit.
There's no better way to say that. With no further ado, let's talk to Hazel. Hazel, thank you so much for joining us on Day 2 Cloud Podcast. This is so exciting to have you. You're about a third of the LinkedIn posts that I see these days because you are so active and we want to hear about it. So first of all, who are you and what do you do?
So I am Hazel. I have a lot of opinions on the internet. That's what a lot of people know me for. But I also do software architecture, infrastructure things. I have done some leadership in engineering, and I've been kind of around the block doing a lot of things as needed with some focus in platform engineering, observability, and leadership, and really trying to figure out how to scale things effectively, how to grow people, and how to sustainably get everyone to where the architecture of your system is an emergent property of having to be in alignment with the company goal.
So just everything was your everything. Answer. Like the only things you focused on are everything I've ever heard of in IT. That's amazing. I read your post about the observations of leadership, where you were talking about stepping up and leading a division and trying to marry those worlds together that you talked about of infrastructure and software development and security and leadership. And I just have so many questions. Can you just tell us like the history of that? I know you told the story in your post, but it sounds like you didn't exactly intend to step up, but the opportunity arose and you did it.
Yeah. You know, that saying about how some leaders are made, some leaders are born, some leaders wake up one day to find out that their manager submitted a 1-week notice. So that's what happened. And so when he did that, he was the combination head of infrastructure and the engineering manager of our team. And it was the right move for him. It was all right, but it did put us in a tough spot. And so what I did was that very day, I reached out to every single person on the engineering leadership team, got on one-on-one with them in like the first few hours of Monday and said, "Oh, what are we doing? What's going on? How can we make sure that we don't get into this situation again? Can we go forward?" And I was very proactive with that. And I managed to take the team of about half kind of wanted to almost quit on the spot because we had a turbulent time and this was sort of yet another bit of turbulence. And I managed to keep the team together, grab everyone together, get a coherent story going. And then by the end of the week, the CTO had announced that I would be sort of the tech lead of the team. But less than a week later, he was so impressed by how I was managing things that he actually ended up stepping me into the interim role of being the engineering manager and the head of infrastructure. And then I did that. I told him, "You have 2 months. There's no ego involved. Either hire a director and keep me as a manager, or hire a manager, keep me as a director. I don't care which one it is, do what's best for the company, but I'm not doing 3.5 jobs for more than 2 months. I need more sleep."
Yeah. Director and manager can mean a lot of different things. So when you were stepping into that sort of dual role, what was the realm of responsibility for the director versus the manager in your organization?
So that was interesting currently because of where everything was at the time. It had a lot of overlap. And so that's why it was one person. Essentially, we had a team that was very, very overworked. treading water, they had about 800% more workload than they actually had bandwidth for the team.
Oof.
And so because of that, the split between manager and director was fuzzy because it was so small. The main thing as a director that I did was I participated in the budgeting work, the organization-wide, like leadership meetings, and really being able to set the tone for what investing in developer experience meant and what we needed to do organization-wide to get the infrastructure onto the right track so that the company could be effective. Because what was happening is you had certain interesting mismatches. Like you had other people on the leadership team thinking that their teams did a certain set of responsibilities around infrastructure, and my team did a different set of responsibilities. And what was happening was because of the state the infrastructure was in, the team that was supposed to handle things end-to-end couldn't. And so they were putting a lot of load and support onto like the infrastructure team. So the infrastructure team had a huge amount of hidden work and a huge amount of like hidden processes and things that should have taken only X amount of time to 3 to 5 times the amount of time and 3 to 5 times the amount of people. And so making that visible and highlighting that and introducing the developer experience platform was some of the biggest leverage things that I did as a director, as well as like setting everything up and like really sort of trying to lay down as much foundation as possible for who would come next. And assuming that that would be me, but I tried to hedge things to make it possible to have people move in.
So it sounds like the director position was really focused on the strategy portion of things and aligning with other teams within the organization, but you also had management responsibility. So I'm assuming that had to do more with interacting with your team and taking care of them on a daily basis.
Yeah. So the management work there was what you might consider typical engineering management. I had career growth for my reports, making sure that they were effective and making sure that they had what they needed, that there's road mapping being done, that things are on track. And one of the most important things that I did at the management level was, here's where a bit of nuance between manager and director. I had to do the work of making work visible, but I had to do it on two fronts. So at the management level, it's making work visible on the team so that you can set expectations of what the team can accomplish. But at the director level, it's about making the work potential of the organization visible so that you can argue or demonstrate what the organization is capable of and what needs to happen in the future, make sure that the business goals in the future can be accomplished.
Totally. Kind of a tactical strategic breakdown.
Yeah.
That makes sense. This is orthogonal a little bit, but how did you prepare as an IC, as an engineer, for stepping this huge role up? So moving from just like maybe strictly tactical into this like very broad strategic leadership role. Were you already involved in those conversations and situations, or was that, I see the head shaking, no, so you just dove in. How did that happen?
So I just dove in. Basically, the second they said that I should step into the interim leadership role, I said, okay, I'm going to need access to everything. I'm going to need all the information, all the meetings, all the everything, put me in the right channels. I need that yesterday because we need to turn this around, really start correcting the situation. And I don't have a lot of time to do that. And then that first week, I read a ton of books and took a bunch of notes. So I read the first 90 days. I read basically everything ever written by Will Larson. I read The Effective Executive. And I read the book from Camille Forner on engineering management and leadership. And then I read the book on making work visible. And that's what I did the first 3 days.
That's a lot of reading. So it sounds like you hadn't been preparing for this transition for, 6 months or a year. Did you have some previous experience at past jobs that helped you in terms of either the management or director side of things?
So what was happening is one of the things that's interesting between being an IC and being a manager or director is when you work as an IC, you want to be well-rounded, you want to be balanced. And when you work as a manager, you can be a bit more lopsided, but you still want kind of that balance. When you're a director, it's so much about your strengths. Can you lean into your strengths? Can you really, really polish them? Can you really multiply them? And it's true, like, the principal and above level in IC as well, where you might be able to be amazingly effective in a lot of areas, but can you be world-class in one?
Mm.
And if you can be at that level, then multiply that and use that. And so whether or not you fit into a company is less about can you do the work and more about that one aspect of you that's world-class. Does that really fit into what the company needs? And so for me, my skill set that I'm world-class in is my ability to read that 400 to 2,000 words a minute and retain like all of it.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So like when I said that I read those like 8 different books on engineering management and strategy and thinking and everything, I read those in 3 days. So I took 1 week out of like the 4 months that I was doing this sort of intern role. And I was like, okay, let me briefly read all the leading theory on how to do this so that I have the background context. And that took a week. And then I was able to sit down and now that I knew everything, plan out what I needed to do and think about that and then go through and attempt to learn how to do it as fast as possible.
And I think you mentioned earlier, you also reached out to the community, the people you knew, and asked them for a little bit of guidance and help as well. What sort of questions did you ask them? Or you did you just go, help?
Part of it was definitely just help. I don't know what I'm doing. Part of it was also reaching out to them and then saying, like, what should I ask you about? So, like, I have friends of mine who are, like, a senior principal engineer or maybe a director of engineering, or maybe they've been in this leadership position but not this one. Like, what are the things I need to do? And am I identifying the right problems and focusing on them? Because one of the things that's tricky when you're in a position of overwork, they have 2 main strategies to handle overwork. It's very similar to distributed systems. You can reduce the amount of work you're doing, so you can throw it away by shedding load, or you can increase capacity, and that's basically it.
Mm-hmm.
As a manager, you can't do either, really. The manager, your goal is to be an effective and reliable and like accurate communicator of what your bandwidth is and what your flow is and like what these sort of properties are of the team, so that the people who can actually decide whether or not you can really drop load or you can really sort of, if you need to grow the team size at all, those people need to be able to make that decision as early as possible and as effectively as possible. So since I was both, I was able to look at the whole stack and just go, okay, these things need to happen. But demonstrating that and showing that to the organization is a lot harder. I was fortunate in that the organization, like the leadership team, was willing to essentially take me at face value. And that is one of the main reasons why this worked as well as it did. But otherwise, one of my weaknesses was I didn't necessarily have a lot of knowledge on how to show a compelling story over time. And I didn't have the time to show that story.
Mm.
So the story would have been, here's kind of proof of where our tech debt is, where our business liabilities are, where everything else is, and like, how are we able to keep up with it? And how is that hurting the business or causing risk? And I didn't have the months required to build up that case. I had like a couple weeks to go, hey, this is really bad. And here's kind of, I'm going to point at some general, really funky looking numbers and just vaguely hand wave over everything. And then ask you to believe me and allocate me like 80% of the headcount budget for the whole organization. And they were like, sure, which was not the correct answer. If a director says, hey, trust me, bro, can you just take the headcount from everyone else in the organization and give it to me? The correct answer is no, give me evidence. But they did actually do that because at the time, like, I was able to make a people argument rather than like a quantitative argument. I was able to make a qualitative one. And one of my other skills is people.
Yeah, I mean, apparently, because you made such an extraordinarily compelling argument that they gave you. I mean, I'm assuming millions of dollars in funding to hire people, and that's huge. I don't think I've ever convinced anyone to give me $1 million before, but I'll work on it now that I know I can.
It's interesting because the way I was able to do it was we went through a couple different organizations, a couple different verticals in the company, and essentially said, sort of, here's what you get if you give us your headcount. And then combine that with, we need these sorts of things. Here's kind of the risk. And I wasn't able to show things, but I was able to detail out the risks. Like one of the big ones was, if we don't do this sort of thing, we're at risk for maybe having a huge amount of struggle with our compliance program. So some security things, like security can't implement things without us. We can't do that. The product teams can't implement things without us, but we don't have the bandwidth. And so we have become the limiting factor in the whole organization. And so we needed to move resources over in order to make that happen.
Do you think they were already somewhat aware of the bottleneck issue based off of, you know, the fact that your previous boss left on such short notice, or there were other signs that there was definitely trouble on the horizon?
There were signs, but it was one of those things where if you don't have enough knowledge of something or enough awareness, really, the difference between a sign that something is a problem and a sign that something isn't a problem is actually almost the same, because it's a signal to noise ratio. But if you're getting no signal, you also get no noise. So you don't know if there's a problem if you can't see the problem. And you can't see if there's a problem if people are so overworked that they're essentially treading water.
Totally. What you don't know that you don't know.
And people can drown silently in a pool kind of thing, to make a more of an analogy.
Well, how do you find that if you don't know that you don't know it? How do you find it? How do you start looking for stuff like that?
The leadership team didn't know it. And like the rest of the organization didn't know it to that extent. I came in, and the second I came in, I knew because I had a gut instinct about it. I had seen this kind of indication before. I had seen this pattern before. And I had this intuitive sense of the system and the constraints, and it was about showing it. And one of the things that I did was we had like a support channel in Slack for the team to help other teams. And that channel had just information in the channel and other channels would happen. And things would happen in DMs and things would happen everywhere. So I moved everything into that one channel, closed out a bunch of other channels, and then wired that channel up into Jira service management so that every time someone made something, I made a ticket. You could just hit an emoji button, you would get a ticket.
Oh.
And the point of that was just to show that the tickets were growing without bound and that they could not be resolved. And then I had a conversation with the CTO once that was interesting. He looked at these tickets and he said, these tickets are so easy. They should be taking 5 minutes. And I said, yeah, this one that should be taking 5 minutes took 50 hours of people meetings and it took 3 weeks and we don't have the bandwidth to do it. So we'll get to it like, you know, in a couple of weeks. And he's like, are they all like that? And I'm like, yeah, one worse.
That is quite the challenge to be confronted with. And headcount can help, but I've also heard of scenarios where throwing headcount at the problem is actually counterproductive because anybody you bring in has to be brought up to speed. The only people that can teach them are the people who are already overburdened with work. And so for a certain period of time, when you bring on that headcount, you overall become less productive until those people come up to speed. Was that your experience or did you find a way around that particular problem?
It was my experience, but we also hacked a couple of things to make that work better. One of the things that happened was my director came in and I became just the engineering manager right around that time. And then we got the headcount to fully go through to hire a bunch of people. So what we did was we hired basically everybody in 4 weeks. We just told the whole rest of the company, hey, you're going to see my team more or less drop off the face of the planet for like this whole quarter. Don't worry about it. We're hiring a whole bunch of people. We're going to do a bunch of things. We're going to bring them up to speed. And also we managed to time that around the holidays, which helped a bit because people kind of naturally slow down after Thanksgiving, particularly in America. Late November, mid-December is when we brought in a bunch of people. We started trying to hire like mid-October. And then by mid-December, we had signed offers from about 5 to 8 people, which is a lot of interviewing.
Yeah.
We put someone on a team in the UK. We had 3 people on the infrastructure team. We built an entirely new developer experience team out of scratch. We hired a data infrastructure manager, an engineering developer experience manager. And we reorged and brought in some people from a different organization under my director. So she went from having 1 team, my team, to having like 6.
Wow.
In less than 2 months. And if you do it that quickly, then it's a bit unstable with the people. So you need to make sure that you have a really strong people culture, which I knew was the case on my team because my team actually scored so much higher on employee engagement, company happiness, like trust and leadership than everyone else in the company. But I knew we could add a lot of instability into the team and they could take it and they can handle it. That's when I knew they were able to handle growing the team into an organization.
So they have those skills and you have the opportunity because you're dropping a bunch of headcount on the team and you have organizational buy-in because they know things are going to get worse before they get better. Mm-hmm. And then how do you deliver the value of those new people? There's so much work. There's a lot of chaos for new hiring. How do you get them all marching in the same direction? Is that a lot of meetings with people? Is that a lot of documentation? How do you herd the cats, so to speak?
Yeah, so that one was interesting. That was where having my director really helped. And you could definitely see my inexperience doing there. I had the idea of how to do it, but she's the one that came through and said, okay, like, I agree. Here's kind of what we need to do. Here's how to make the cats do it. And essentially, the mantra became like, do less work in progress, and then, you know, get more done. And like I knew that already. But having the knowledge to say sometimes that means the entire team does nothing but this one thing together. And turning the entire team into a very single-threaded operation really, really helped. Having mob programming also helped a lot, where we had the whole team just like in a Zoom call, or like two groups of the team in two different Zoom calls, doing that together and having the team work on one problem and one refactoring set of things and just working on that. It massively increases your speed to having people know the infrastructure. It is so beneficial for knowledge sharing. It gets people working together. And it's the closest thing you have to like that on-site building team camaraderie that really helps get everybody on board and get them working faster together a lot better. So rather than having a couple months for people to be useful, we had the new people meaningfully contributing within the week.
That's tremendous.
Getting to know everybody and chatting. And I agree, like getting the lay of the land culture-wise. That's interesting. I hate saying stuff like this in public forums because I'm giving ammunition to people that say like, bring everyone back to the office. It's great, everyone, because I love not being in the office. But that kind of stuff is, yeah, I'd certainly miss the camaraderie, the getting to know people.
Well, so it wasn't even the office. And it was actually more effective because we weren't in the office. We had the Zoom calls, we had like the group mobbing. And group mobbing actually works really, really well over video chat if people like know how to do it. And it's a slightly different skill set than doing in person, but it's actually like just as effective. And you can do it with a hybrid setting, you can do it fully remote, you can do it in person. In person is good for very high fidelity conversation, but it's not necessarily that good for working together on one thing and like learning it. The high bandwidth learning and like mobbing together, I think honestly is more effective almost like in a Zoom call or in something like that, because someone can share their screen and they can draw on the screen and everyone can see and they can work on things together. And people can pull up their notes on a different computer. Otherwise, you end up with either everyone staring at one screen and having useless opinions because they can't look things up, or everyone's surrounding the table and they're all looking at their screen. And they're all like saying, oh, hey, have you tried this? And then they can't really see the other person's screen. You're either trying to replicate the remote experience of mob programming in person, or you're not doing mob programming well. So like the mob programming is actually almost more effective in remote. But in person is the best for like team building, getting people to know each other and having like sort of nuanced group discussion. So I like the hybrid experience of having people work remotely. And then trying to have frequent enough offsite that you keep the whole team together, you have them around for a couple of days, and then sometimes do some work, sometimes do some planning, sometimes do things. But anything deeper than the high-level strategy isn't going to work in person. And it's not going to be the most effective use of your time. But high-level strategy, getting people working together, getting people to know each other and have fun together and like eat food together, just like spend time, that's worth it.
Yeah, and that's the sort of thing. You don't need everybody in the office every day to do that. You do, like you said, an offsite or some sort of gathering once a quarter or something, so you can get that sort of social interaction. But I really like what you're saying about the mob programming idea. Did you pick up that idea through one of the many books that you read, or is that something that you'd participated in before and so you knew how to implement?
Maximize cloud efficiency with Doit, the trusted partner in multi-cloud management for thousands of companies worldwide. Doit's innovative tools, expert insights, and smart technology make optimization simple. Elevate your cloud strategy and simplify your cloud spend. Visit doit.com. That's doit.com. Doit, your cloud simplified.
I knew of it. I didn't necessarily read it in any of the books, actually. It is a technique that most people relegate to extreme programming, which is where it comes from. Mm-hmm. And it's something that a lot of people in a certain community will really espouse, but it tends to have that same sort of single-minded thought leadership without the context of, say, like test-driven development or like behavior-driven development, domain-driven development, mob programming. Like, they're all useful techniques and they all have their own place. And it's nice to know about them and know when to apply them. But this one actually kind of emerged almost naturally from saying everyone's going to work on the same thing. And if you're stuck at all, join with people. And we're going to do the first one together. And then we did the first one together. And everyone's like, this is actually really useful. Let's do the second one together. Let's do the third one together. And then people started breaking off and they went, okay, I'm going to do like these five sort of little things. And some people went over here. And then if someone said, oh, I want to learn about this part of the code base, they just tag along. And within a week, you had people, like the entire mode of working on the team had shifted. rather than having people just working independently, people would say, hey, I'm going to work on this one thing. I'm going to drop a link to a video chat right here. And if you want to just hop in, let's do it.
That's incredible. That's so cool to hear how quickly that culture can transform. And especially the sort of engineering-driven people leadership, I think is really interesting and unique. So in my experience, you find really good engineers or really good people managers, and marrying them together is super cool. And I remember reading from your article that you posted about leadership that you are no longer in that leadership role. Now you're back in an IC role. Is that right? And if so, like, how did that happen? Why did you do that when you're so clearly, like, you know, extraordinary at this leadership thing? And then you're like, I'm not going to do it anymore. I'm back to IC.
I'm very inexperienced. This is my first time as an engineering manager and first time as, like, at a director sort of level. We hired a director, and that's one of the best things that happened. We got really lucky with her. She's amazing. She's like me, but 15 years older. It's actually really funny. People mistake us for each other all the time. She helped me a lot with that. I've learned a lot from her. It's been fantastic. But having me as a manager, I'm really, really good at the people skill. I am 2,000% a people manager. Like, I'm not a therapist, but I'm a people manager. People love me. People want to connect with me. People want to follow me. People gel around me. That's 80% of management. But the other 80% is all the other stuff. And I am very replaceable as a manager. I am, however, irreplaceable as an architect. It's really easy to find someone who is better at me than, like, the logistical side of management. Having someone who's good at the logistical side of management and good at the people side, a little harder. But we needed logistical management a little bit. And we had the people side, we reorganized a little bit, and then we had one manager left over. So he actually came over and became the head of developer tooling. We split the infrastructure and developer tooling. We brought in QA over from a different part of the organization, and we have three teams under him. So that was great. That was fantastic. And it was a really good move. And then it meant that because I was really replaceable as a manager and irreplaceable as, like, an architect or an IC, I ended up stepping into a principal architect role in the platform organization. And now that we had a platform organization, it finally made sense. So my goal there is to help the entire company get better at everything and figure out, like, how to make alignment with the company goals, with the company, like, needs, an emergent property of our architecture, of our way of working, and our infrastructure.
And this is just something that I've kind of personally experienced. I have avoided management as much as I can. I don't like being in charge of people, you know, but I accidentally lead people all the time. And I can imagine if folks know that you were in charge recently and successful, it sounds like, do you find that you're, even though you're an IC, you're kind of accidentally leading the division? You kind of have to be careful with saying, we're going to do that when you're not really in charge of that because, like, people will follow you. Is that your experience?
That is my experience to an extent. Luckily, I'm visibly not in management anymore, and I'm an IC. And so one of the things you need to do is that you need to lead from influence rather than authority. But that has always been my management style. So it's been a natural transition. It has a lot more weight when you're a director and you say, I think we should do this. People are going to take the I think out of there and just go, you're saying we're going to do this. And I'm like, okay. But now, as an IC, if I say, I think we should do this, I still can't quite say it that way. But leaning for influence, what do you need? How can we do this? Can I explain things in a certain way and just sort of show you the possibilities? And one of the possibilities we're going to kind of highlight is, I want to make sure that it works with you. And sort of, hopefully, at the end of the conversation, they like that one too, because it's genuinely the best fit. When it's less about, we need to go in this direction, and more about, here's the outcome we need. I want to help you get here. Have opinions about how I think it's best to get there based on my understanding of your perspective. But I want to validate that as I help you kind of go in that direction and figure out how to get there.
So you're using a combination of the technical skills you picked up and your depth of knowledge in that realm to kind of figure out what you think the best path is. But then you have to use your people skills, your soft skills to convince others. Finding that combination of someone who's good with the soft skills side of thing and is also good with the technical side of thing can be very challenging. Is there some secret to developing the soft skills side of things? Because I know a lot of folks, at least people that tend to listen to this podcast come from a very technical background. I know I certainly did. I know, Kyler, you did as well. And so developing those soft skills is something that is sometimes not focused on. But I think to be truly successful in a manager role that you are in, or even in the role that you're in now as a principal architect, is you need those skills to interact with other people.
Yeah, there's no certification in soft skills, Ned. Like, I can go get a Cisco cert in routing, but like, where's the soft skills cert? Come on, let's go, industry.
So it's hard because I'm deaf, ADHD, and autistic. So between those three, I had essentially zero soft skills, but I learned them somehow. I read a bunch of things on the subject of like how to talk with people, how to like understand them, how to get things working, and how to really work with people. There are actually books on the subject, like Crucial Conversations is a great one. Understanding how empathy works is another sort of really valuable skill set. As for example, empathy has four components. So empathy requires you to like really actually understand a person and listen to them. They have to feel like you're listening to them. And then you need to connect with the part of you that resonates with their experience. So you need to find some part of you that's been there, that's done that, that has that empathy, and build that bridge somehow. And then once you build that bridge, just be there for them. It's not about solutioning. It's not about problem solving. It's not about any of that stuff. Like, even if they say, hey, please help me solve my problem, they're lying. They don't actually want you to solve the problem.
This is kind of good marriage advice, too, in my experience. So, like, we can apply this everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good marriage advice. It's good relationship advice. It's good advice in general for a lot of things. Like, you want people to feel heard and understood so that you can understand, like, what's actually going through their head and, like, what their perspective actually is. If you can't get there, you're not going to get them to where you need them to go or to where they need to go. You have to be able to find them.
Right. Oh, that is so hard to do. And sometimes you're already under an enormous amount of stress and workload, and being able to take the time for another human being and see them as another human and not a problem that just walked in your door or just pinged you on Slack, it's so challenging. Are there certain practices or something that you do mentally that allows you to empathize even when you're under what must have been an enormous amount of work initially?
There are two really, really big things. The first one is one of the biggest things you can do as a leader is manage your adaptive capacity. Effective leaders, really effective leaders, can have the most full schedule possible and imaginable, walk around the company, find some random person who's having a meltdown, or having like a bad moment, or having something cancel the whole rest of their day and spend 4 hours with them. If you can't do that, you're not managing your adaptive capacity. Mm. If you're not managing your adaptive capacity, you cannot take the time that's needed to be there in the moment with people that need that. And if you can't do that, you are not an effective leader. So figuring out the adaptive capacity is super critical and it's very hard. But when you get that, it's a secret superpower and helps you with like time management, helps you with a whole bunch of other things. The other one is figuring out how to ground yourself instantly. It's a parenting skill. It's a life hack. It's a whole bunch of other things. You have sort of like the five levels of like, how big of a problem is this really? So like, is anyone immediately bleeding out and dying? Like, do I need to evacuate the city because there's a volcano? No. Okay. So it's the next. It's not a volcano. It is, right? And then you go down. Mm-hmm. And it turns out basically every problem you're ever going to encounter in business, it's like, you know, one or two. It's like an oops, or it's, you know, like maybe a hiccup. Maybe I need a moment. Maybe I need, but like, so what if I'm a day late for the budget?
Right.
And like, you know, people say, oh, or if we're losing, you know, $1 million an hour, and because this infrastructure is down, is a huge critical thing. So what? Nobody's dying. Nobody will die. We do not need to evacuate the city. You can take a moment. Kind of like that trope in horror films where as you're walking up to the car, normally, normal day, you walk up to the car, you take your keys, you unlock the car, you just get in, it takes about 1 second. But if Jack the Ripper is just like running behind you and you're like so panicked and everything, like there's always a scene like this in a horror film where someone's running, they trip, they stumble, they panic, they fumble, they lose their keys, they drop them, they can't get the key in the door. And it takes them 5 minutes to get into the car. And normally it takes you about 10 seconds. So if you're in the middle of a crisis, the first thing you should do is remember that it's probably not actually that big of a crisis. And you should take 30 seconds, take a nice deep breath, and realize that if you took those 30 seconds, you could take another one if you need them. And then you can go and actually solve the problem when you're calm.
This is fantastic advice in everything. I feel like I'm learning about how to be a better parent and a better partner. And you're talking about how to lead a division of techies. This is super cool. Mm-hmm. Well, let's close this up with, I think, a final question here, which is, how do I grow up to be you? How do other people that are listening step up into your shoes? Because it sounds like you have been a therapist and an engineer and a director and a sort of C-level leader in this arena. How do I do all that and still sleep?
Who says I sleep? Just kidding. I would say, so my motivation that when I started out, my motivation was I want to be a force multiplier for other people. And so when I started off my career, it was, I need to be a force multiplier for myself. And then can I be a force multiplier to someone next to me? And then can I be a force multiplier for a team? But now it's, can I be a force multiplier for the whole organization, for the whole company? I want to get the whole company moving faster because I helped them get to there. Like, I don't want them to depend on me, but I want them to move faster because I helped amplify the whole organization at that level. And so that kind of drives everything I do and everything I learn. And so really I'm sitting there and trying to learn all the ways to do that, all the ways to connect with people and building that empathy with different people, learning what I can, but from the focus of how do I become that force multiplier? When you have that force multiplier, you start to really look at how can I take these 50 million different concepts and learn them in one way? Like, that's why a lot of the times when I say something, people go, oh, that applies to everything. Yeah, I try really, really hard to make sure that everything that I say applies to everything, because that's how I keep it in my head. It's not, how do I be a better leader? And that doesn't start with putting on this one particular flavor of power tie. It's, how do I be a better human and a force multiplier to people around me? And I want to generalize that in a way that works in every scenario. And there's going to be a bunch of things in your pocket. There's going to be a bunch of techniques that you have, but really you can only keep about like 5 to 8 techniques in your head that's ready to go at any time. So pick your 5 and really dial in on them.
That's fantastic. All right. I think we're going to close this up. And for our final question, like always, where can the audience find out more about you? Where can they find you on the internet?
You can find me on the internet at hazelweekly.me as my website. I'm also Hazel Weekly on basically everything. I'm on Mastodon. I have an account on X so that people don't name snipe me, but I don't log in anymore. I have LinkedIn. You can find me there. And otherwise, I have a contact page on my website that lists anything else I forgot about.
That sounds wonderful.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Hazel, so much for being a guest today on Day 2 Cloud. And hey, listeners out there, virtual high fives to you for tuning in. If you have suggestions for future shows or other awesome people we should talk to, let us know. You can fill out the feedback form at packetpushers.net/FU, or you can find me or Kyler on LinkedIn and send us a nice little message. Our DMs are like mostly open, I think, or at least can't speak for Kyler, but yep, she's nodding her head. So you can message either of us on LinkedIn. That's probably the best way to find either of us lurking around the internet. If you want to have some more interactions with the community of Packet Pushers people, did you know you don't have to scream into the technology void all alone? That's right, Packet Pushers has a Slack network set up that you can join. It's a marketing-free zone for folks to come and tell war stories, help each other with their problems, or just vent about stuff. That's cool too. You can find that at packetpushers.net/Slack. Hopefully we'll see you in the channels. Until next time, just remember, cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans.